You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. I'm your host, as always, Larry Lease. On today's episode, we are diving into the Pathway Murders. Before we do that, we'd like to remind you to give us your thoughts in the comment section below. Give us your thoughts on this case or any future cases you want us to cover in future episodes of Cold Case Friday, Murder Monday, or any other topics you think we should focus on. And of course, as obvious, if there's something I got wrong, something I got right, that you agree or disagree with, let me know. So with that, we're going to dive right into today's episode. The history of forensics dates all the way back to the year 1248. How is that possible, you ask? It's a book written in China, whose title translates into English as Washing Away of Wrongs. And in that book is the earliest documented use of a forensic technique. There had been a murder in a Chinese village where the victim had been killed with a sickle, which is basically a curved knife. It's the thing that's on the Chinese flag, if I'm not mistaken. And the dude investigating the murder assembled all the suspects in an outdoor location and had them lay their sickles down in front of him. When a swarm of flies landed on one particular sickle, drawn to the traces of blood that had been left behind, that's when the investigator knew who the murderer was. And that person then confessed to the murder, validating the investigator's method. You may be surprised to know that fingerprint identification is barely 100 years old. It wasn't until the 18th and 19th centuries that scientists even recognized that fingerprints were unique to an individual. And only in 1902 was fingerprinting first used to solve a crime. That's around the time scientists first discovered blood types, which itself would eventually be implemented into forensics as well. We've come a long way since then. The Golden State Killer, California's most notorious unidentified serial killer, was finally arrested in 2018 after being identified with forensic genealogy. And since then, over 200 other cold case murders, some dating back to the 50s, have been solved using the same technique, where the DNA of an unidentified criminal offender is uploaded into a genealogy database, and after the criminal's relatives are identified, genealogists construct a family tree and narrow down potential suspects until they find their killer. But did you know that DNA profiling itself is actually, relatively speaking, a fairly new thing? The first murder case where DNA was used to weed out the killer was only 35 years ago. In 1987, and that's the case we're going to be talking about today. The first case to use DNA to weed out suspects. The villages of Enderby and Narborough in England are pretty typical of what you'll find if you travel to the part of the country known as the Midlands. These villages have remained largely unchanged for centuries, with most families having resided in the region for many generations. In fact, when the area began to see a big wave of newcomers in the 70s and 80s, that caused a lot of Enderby and Narborough locals to fear that the identities of their quaint little towns might get lost or diluted if this influx continued. The population of both villages was about 6,000 to 7,000 residents apiece, and these were peaceful places where violent crime just didn't happen. If you're a Kathleen man, Narborough seemed like the ideal place to raise her two young daughters. Susan and Linda, after a failed marriage in an attempt to establish herself in Leicester, which was where she was born and raised. Kathleen, who went by Kath, decided she needed some space from her mother and ended up settling in the small village where the gardens were well manicured and the homes looked like something out of a storybook. And honestly, it's true. I mean, if you look at all the pictures of Scotland and England and that area, the places are just so quaint and look, well, perfect. I think mainly because there's a lot of stuff there that's preserved and there's a lot of history there, so they don't really want to disrupt anything or harm anything. I mean, no offense to us Americans, but there's like history there. It's just so different compared to when you're on the other side of the world. And it's completely understandable to me why Kath is going to take her two daughters and like run away to one of these villages and raise her family. Now, sometime in the late 70s, Kath met a man named Eddie Eastwood and was smitten, smitten with him. They moved in together, and in December of 1980, they were married.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Kath had a third daughter with him soon after, and the family moved into a bigger, semi-detached house. And life was good for Eddie and Kath and their new family in this English village, even if Eddie at this point was working 90 hours a week. He had gone through bankruptcy in the mid-70s and was now looking to clear up the debts related to it in the 80s. But the couple was doing well, and Kath's daughters were happy and well-adjusted, especially Linda, who by 1983 had blossomed into a popular and polite 15-year-old girl, well-liked at Lutterworth Grammar School, where she was a student. Some saw her as shy and a little old-fashioned, but she had no shortage of friends. She was, by all accounts, a typical teenager and very independent for her age, and that's what the Eastwoods life looked like back in 1983. Living in this village in England together, adding on to their family, and enjoying life. It was November 21st, 1983, and it was a cold and frosty evening. It was around 5 p.m. when Linda, the teenager, left the house to babysit for a neighbor. She got back home around 6:20 for a quick meal with her stepdad, Eddie. By this point, the temperature had taken even more of a dip, and Linda was scheduled to babysit for another neighbor, so she slid into a sweatshirt and darted out the door. But she returned home shortly after. That neighbor, it turned out, was on sick leave, and let Linda know she wouldn't be needed that night. So Linda spent a few minutes watching TV, and then she prepared to leave again, telling Kath, her mother, that she was going to visit her friend Karen. Linda told her mother she'd probably stay at Karen's for a while and then stop by her friend Carolyn's. "Don't worry," she said, "I'll be home by 10. So Linda went on her way, and it was about 7:10 at this point, as she was heading towards Karen's. Linda actually crossed paths with another friend of hers, Margaret, who later recalled that Linda seemed like her normal, cheerful self during this interaction. Linda then popped into Karen's place, but it turned out that her friend wasn't home. So Linda talked for a few minutes with the girl's mother, and then told her she was off to see her other friend Carolyn in the neighboring village of Enderby. Now Carolyn had actually borrowed some record albums from Linda, and now Linda wanted to pick them up. So she's like, "Oh well, it's fine, Karen wasn't home. I'm just going to go to Caroline's, pick up my record albums, and then I'm just going to go home." And then she left. She left to go to Caroline's. But as always in these cases, Linda never made it to Caroline's house. Kath and Eddie Eastwood, Linda's mother and stepfather, had been out that evening playing darts at the local pub and got back home about half an hour after midnight to find Kath's oldest daughter, Susan, still waiting up. "Linda's not home," she immediately told them, sounding very concerned. This was totally out of character for Linda, as I explained earlier, and Kath's heart started racing immediately. She had told her she was going to be home by 10. Now it's almost midnight and she's not home. Eddie got into his car, began driving around the neighborhood, checking all the local teen hangouts. He then walked the black pad, which was a footpath that ran alongside Carlton Hayes Hospital, which, by the way, was a psychiatric hospital whose grounds had many acres of farmland, that separated the two villages, Narborough and Enderby. The hospital was torn down in the mid-90s, but if you look at its former location on Google Maps, you can see just how much land the hospital occupied. It was practically the same size as either of the two villages. So you have this hospital, and then on one side of the hospital is Enderby, on the other side is Narborough, and in the middle is this huge hospital with a land with a path that cuts through on either side of the hospital to get to the two villages. So on one side of the hospital to the east ran the footpath known as 10 Pound Lane, and on the other side was another footpath called the Black Pad, which was the shortcut that Linda was known to take, the one that she would have taken the night to get to Caroline's, which is why her stepdad is now searching it. You know, I don't know if I'm taking a road called the Black Pad, just saying. Also on the fact that it runs right next to a psychiatric hospital. Yeah, I don't know. And both of these footpaths, join Narborough with Enderby. Like I said, they were relatively well-traveled by locals. And if Linda had been heading to her friend Carolyn's, it was very likely she'd have taken the Black Pad. So Eddie searched up and down this footpath, which was not lit up at night. There was no lighting of any kind, though there was a full moon out that night. So Eddie was able to see along the path fairly well, but he couldn't find Linda anywhere. After an hour, Eddie gave up and returned home to phone the police and report Linda missing. Eddie could hear the lack of urgency in the voice of the policeman on the other side, and so he stressed that Linda always returned home before 10. But with the report made, there was nothing more for Linda's family to do but spend a sleepless night waiting for some word, hopefully from Linda, and hopefully that everything was okay. At around 7:40 the next morning, a hospital porter was on his way to work at the psychiatric hospital, walking the black pad footpath, when he looked through the wrought iron fence separating the footpath from the grassy fields of the hospital, and there he spotted what looked like a mannequin. I mean, maybe once in a blue moon it's a mannequin, but it's never a mannequin, come on. And you know, obviously, this worker can't be sure that it's not a dead body, so he flagged down a colleague who was driving past and brought him to the location with him. The colleague walked through the open gate into the fenced-off area and saw what was clearly not a mannequin, but a human being. A young woman, partially nude, with bruises and a bloody nose, and a scarf knotted tightly around her neck. He bent down to check the young woman for a pulse, but the rigor mortis made it instantly clear that he wouldn't find one. Meanwhile, all Eddie Eastwood could talk about at work that morning was how his teenage stepdaughter was missing. And sometime before noon, word reached Eddie that a body had been found along the black pad footpath. He left work that moment and raced to the location, pushing past police barricades. The police took notes and told him to go home and wait for a call. They needed to investigate, and he realized upon walking home that he had passed right by that body the night before, within 3 yards of it, during his search for his daughter. A short time later, Eddie was summoned back to the footpath and allowed to look at the body. "That's her," he told police, who lifted up the shiny black tarp. Eddie immediately recognized the jacket and the scarf, the one that was tightly wrapped around her neck, as Linda's. Eddie returned to the house with two detectives, and they asked Linda's mother, Kath, a battery of questions about Linda, whether she had a boyfriend, if she'd been wearing earrings the night of her death, and so forth. Kath was in such a daze that everything only half registered to her. Examination of the crime scene made it very clear that Linda had been sexually assaulted. Her jeans and her underpants had been tossed into a pile several feet away from where her body was found, and her sweater had been pushed up. Postmortem examination confirmed that Linda was raped, probably after being strangled to death, which is a pretty big clue because it's pretty distinctive to assault a body after the person has died. Police felt that the killer had to be someone local because an outsider to the area likely wouldn't have known about the footpath that everyone crosses through to get to the two villages, nor how to get to the other side of the fence where Linda was found. And of course, the psychiatric hospital, right near the footpath, offered the most obvious possible solution, which is that a patient from the hospital had killed Linda. But the police investigators believe it was more likely that the killer was living a normal life in the community. So although everyone's first jump is someone escaped from the hospital and killed her, the police are kind of like, we don't think that, we think it was someone who lived in the community, which I don't know if that's any any better. In the immediate aftermath of Linda's murder, there was some speculation in the press that Linda's killing may have been linked to another recent slaying. The rape and murder of 16-year-old Colette Aram. Apologies for probably butchering her name. Now, Colette's murder had occurred 3 weeks earlier, 30 miles to the north in the town of Keyworth. Like Linda, Colette had been walking home from a friend's home when she was confronted, strangled, and found the next morning. And both victims lived near the M1 motorway. Though Colette had been abducted from the scene and taken elsewhere before being dumped, and spoiler alert, Colette's murder was solved in 2009, and there was no connection to Linda. It's kind of hard. I mean, she was murdered somewhere that's not really out in the open. It's kind of just sitting there. Like, how do you... I mean, you start the story with DNA, but other than that, I mean, you're not going to see anything. You're not going to find anything except DNA on your body. Although detectives didn't know this at the time, they didn't know that the two murders weren't connected. But despite that, they actually continued investigating Linda's murder on its own. They were like, we're not going to lump these two girls together, even though they were found 30 miles apart. We're going to take a look at Linda's murder as a hometown murder, essentially. Detectives were interviewing people in the area of the footpath on the night of Linda's murder, and they learned that a girl fitting Linda's description had been seen with what witnesses would describe as a punk rocker. Remember, this is 1983, so punk was definitely a thing. This was peak punk era. And this guy that witnesses saw, they thought Linda was with, he was your prototypical punk. Spiked hair, dark clothes. And the two of them were seen at a bus stop. And they were also spotted dashing across a busy street, forcing one motorist to slam on the brakes. So several people came forward and said they think they saw Linda with this punk-looking guy. According to news reports, that motorist spoke briefly to them after they dashed across and made him slam on his brakes, which sounds like a euphemism before he cussed them out. Like he just yelled at them 100%. But anyways, the police investigating Linda's murder became convinced she had some kind of date or prearranged meeting with this punk rocker on the night of her death. They became convinced that although you guys think Linda is such this good girl who's going to Caroline's, they believe something else. The assumption they were working on was Linda left her home, ran into her friend Margaret on the way to Karen's, got to Karen's, talked to her mom, who she also told she was going to see Carolyn, but once she left Karen's home, she actually met up with this punk with spiked hair, and they were spotted together. Police later released what they called an artist's conception of the punk. They were really focusing on this punk, and they spent months trying to draw whoever this was in for questioning. They considered this to be their strongest lead. But the punk wasn't the only person witnesses came forward about in Linda's murder case. Some other unidentified people that witnesses reported, including a young male in his late teens who was seen running from the area looking frightened, and a man about 20 years old with a stocky build and dark, maybe red or brown, curly or layered hair, who was walking from the scene with his shoulders hunched up. And this is something interesting that happens in a lot of these cases. When you ask eyewitnesses to come forward, it's like a lot of them were live at the exact same place, seeing 10 different realities. The only other potential useful detail from the night of the murder is that one witness heard someone shouting, "No, no, no," and sounding very scared at around 9:25 p.m. So police are like, okay, maybe this was her being murdered. So now we have a timeline. But a month after Linda's murder, even after all these potential leads, police were no closer to identifying the killer. A teenage girl had been brutally assaulted and murdered in this quiet English village that was supposed to be safe. Lighting was then installed alongside the black pad footpath, making it somewhat safer to travel at night, in hopes of this never happening again. Though at this point, people were kind of avoiding this footpath like the plague. Word had spread throughout the community, and Linda's murder was on everyone's mind. People were horrified, and it was covered in the local newspapers almost every day. Linda's funeral took place on February 2, 1984. It was attended by over 100 friends and family members. Mourners, described as young punks and leather-jacketed teenagers, even showed up to pay their respects with wreaths that they laid outside of the church. and the police, all the while, were keeping a watchful eye on the event. In fact, they even set up video surveillance and were recording everyone who attended the services so they could review the tape for anyone they hadn't interviewed. And although DNA profiling wasn't a thing yet, forensic science did look at blood type, and more specifically, blood enzymes. That was already happening, and the semen taken from Linda's body revealed the killer had type A blood and a PGM1 plus enzyme profile, which would only match 10% of the male population. But as the months wore on, the investigation just wasn't going anywhere. Despite that they had this blood DNA, the police and Linda's family believed that someone out there knew who the killer was and was shielding him. They believed that whoever this killer was, their behavior would have changed after the crime, enough to arouse the suspicions of their own families and friends. But as much as they kept urging that hypothetical person to come forward, nobody did. And the trauma of Linda's murder was really taking a toll on her family. Eddie, Linda's stepfather, fell into a depression and was no longer able to work 90 hours a week. And the loss of income resulted in a second bankruptcy. And the once daily coverage of the crime had now dwindled to weekly and then monthly. It just happens, these cases grow old. But starting in March 1985, news articles began appearing touting this brand new process that was being developed, which scientists were calling DNA profiling. We take it for granted almost because it's so normal now. However, a spokesman for the Home Office, which is in charge of the police and courts, said the technique was expensive and predicted it would not be used routinely in the near future. And then all the articles go on to say that DNA fingerprinting had already been used in Britain to prove maternity in an immigration case. The spokesman said the government planned to introduce it the following year in a yet-to-be-chosen criminal court case. So they're going to choose a case to try to test the theory. Flash forward to Thursday, July 31st, 1986, 2 years after Linda's murder. It was 3:30 p.m. and a 15-year-old girl named Dawn Ashworth was getting off work, ending her shift at Enderby News, the local newsstand. And Dawn had a lot in common with Linda, actually. Not only was she the same age Linda had been when she was killed, she also attended the same school. And just like Linda, was an upbeat, popular, happy young woman and a familiar face in the community. Dawn was in an especially high spirits on this day because she had a vacation planned with her parents for the weekend to a seaside resort town just a couple of hours away. And so I'm going to guess it's like a place where the locals would go to vacation a lot. Dawn went home and told her mother Barbara that she was planning to meet her friends, Sue and Sharon, in a neighboring Narborough for tea. Her mom said okay, but told her to be back by 7 sharp because the family had committed to going to a birthday party for the little boy of a family friend. A little boy that Dawn actually babysat a few times. Dawn already had plans to see a friend that night, but she agreed that she would cancel those plans and meet back by 7. And then she set out, first stopping by Enderby News, her workplace, to buy some candy and a present for the little birthday boy. And then she left to continue on to Narborough. Now the quickest route to Narborough was through 10 Pound Lane, the other footpath opposite of the black pad that cut through the sprawling grounds of the psychiatric hospital. And again, Dawn is going to cut through this path to get to the other side. Well, it sounds like this crazy person who's killing people is just like watching those paths. Dawn's father had warned her many times not to use these footpaths because of Linda's murder. He's like, you're basically now her same age. Do not walk these paths. Linda's murder had sown fear in the heart of the community, and everyone was young. Daughters had grown a little more vigilant and protective. But it was broad daylight at this point. This day, mid-afternoon, and this route cut the travel time nearly in half. So Dawn made this decision to travel 10 Pound Lane that day, and she soon safely made her way to her friend's Sharon's house. However, once she got there, Sharon's mother came to the door with news that Sharon had already left town with Sue, the friend that she was supposed to be meeting up with. The friend's mother suggested to Dawn that she just try Sue's house. So Dawn left and knocked on Sue's door. But Sue's mother told Dawn that Sue wasn't there either and suggested that she go look for her two friends in the village, like they'd already made their way. But it didn't seem like there would be enough time at this point, and it was important to Dawn that she not be late for the birthday party. She already wasted so much time checking both friends' houses, and Dawn was very punctual and always on time. So instead of going to chase her friends in the village, she turned back and headed towards home. The last time anyone saw Dawn alive, she was walking towards the farm gate, about to re-enter 10 Pound Lane. At 7:05 that evening, when Dawn failed to return home promptly at 7, Barbara already knew something was wrong. Dawn had never once been late returning home. A deep feeling of dread overcame Barbara, who left by herself to deliver the presents to the little birthday boy. And she then immediately returned home, only to find that her daughter still hadn't come back. So then, Barbara drove to Sue's house and talked to the girl's mother, who told Barbara that she'd last seen Dawn around 4:30 when she redirected the girl to look for her friends in the village. Barbara drove around the village until she located Dawn's friends, Sharon and Sue, sitting near the newsstand where Dawn worked. They told Dawn's mother that they hadn't seen Dawn all day and had no clue where she might be. Barbara then returned home and was joined by Dawn's father, Robin. The two parents enlisted the help of some friends and began searching around the village, even along the dreaded Black Pad, where Linda Mann had been killed. Now imagine being this family. Your daughter's just gone missing. You know that she's most likely taken the shortcut, and just 2 years earlier, a girl the exact same age, very similar, also babysat, went missing and was murdered on this path. Now you would think after this, they would just close the path down. Another girl goes missing, especially if you don't find the killer. When Dawn still hadn't come back by 9:30 p.m. that night, her family decided to call police and report her missing. And again, another girl had just gone missing on these paths. The very next morning, a large group of uniformed policemen began searching the fields with tracker dogs. One person the search caught the attention of was Kath Eastwood, Linda's mom. The sight of the trackers sent chills down Kath's spine. "Took us right back," she later told the press. "We hoped upon hope that the result wouldn't be the same for this family." But 2 days later, all that hope evaporated when the body of Dawn was found alongside 10 Pound Lane, concealed by dense undergrowth into which her killer had dragged her body. Much like Linda, Dawn's body was nude from the waist down, her bra had been pushed up, and her body had extensive injuries, though it was determined that many of them were from postmortem insect bites. It was found that Dawn had been violently raped and probably struck in the face and neck and strangled to death, but possibly not in that order. The pathologist noted that the sexual assault may have occurred after Dawn's death, so it was believed right from the outset that whoever killed Dawn was the same man who had killed Linda 2 years earlier, whose body had been found only half a mile from the location where Dawn was killed. And the semen taken from Dawn revealed the same blood type and enzyme type as Linda's killer. Again, it's only a 10% match population profile. Now, after the second murder, both villages were in a straight panic. Teenage girls were told to travel in groups, never be alone, and to avoid the footpath. And though Dawn's co-workers at the newsstand tried not to think about what Dawn must have gone through that night, it was hard not to, as every newspaper they sold had Dawn's face on the front page. Police were determined to stop this killer before he struck again, and they were convinced that he would. They launched an extensive investigation with even more muscle and resources than the Linda Mann inquiry. And that's exactly what they call investigations in England. They called them inquiries. The police learned that multiple witnesses had heard screams from the area of 10 Pound Lane around 5 p.m. that day. And two different witnesses say they'd seen a man crouching in the tall grass of an embankment near the footpath. And the description, a white male in his early 20s with blonde hair, was consistent with that of another man who had been seen running across a nearby street, nearly being hit by a car. Then reports came in about a suspicious man who was seen loitering around the crime scene on his motorbike, both on the day of the murder and during the investigation afterward, showing an intense interest in the activity beyond the police tape. That young man was a 17-year-old kitchen porter at the psychiatric hospital. And this man's name, 17-year-old, was Richard Buckland. Now, Buckland and his motorbike had been seen multiple times near 10 Pound Lane throughout the day that Dawn was murdered. He'd been seen driving slowly past her house the day after her murder, had been observed watching the search teams before Dawn's body was found. And then he actually approached one of the investigators to talk to him, claiming he'd seen Dawn walking up to the gate leading into 10 Pound Lane. But the most concerning piece of information about Richard was that he told one of his co-workers about the discovery of the body before it had been in the press, only a few hours after it was found. Plus, he had a reputation around the village for scaring girls as they walked home from school. It was like a hobby for him. For the task force investigating Don's murder, all of this was enough to arrest Richard Buckland and take him in for questioning right away. So they showed up at his house on the morning of August 8th and placed him under arrest, much to the shock of his parents, who just couldn't fathom their son being involved in a murder. Once back at the station, they began their questioning of Buckland, who couldn't account for his movements that day of Don's murder, and struggled with the questions in general, because Buckland did have some intellectual disabilities, and sometimes he trailed off during the questioning into discussions about motorcycles and other unrelated topics. So in the middle of being questioned, he just started talking about motorcycles, but detectives labored hard enough to keep him on track. And during all this, it emerged that he knew details about the crime scene, which had been released into the public, such as what Dawn had been wearing and the position her body was found in. And after 15 hours of questioning, Buckland confessed to raping and murdering Dawn. So now he's charged with Dawn's brutal murder, and it was widely assumed that he was also responsible for Linda's murder 2 years earlier, as it was clearly done by the same perpetrator. However, Buckland denied responsibility for Linda's murder, and also, Richard would have only been 14 years old at the time that Linda was killed. It doesn't make it impossible that he killed Linda, but it's rather unusual for a 14-year-old to commit a crime of this nature. It's happened. There are cases where it's happened, but it's rare. Then again, you may remember that one of the suspicious people that witnesses had seen in the area of Linda's death around the time she was killed, was a teenage boy. Multiple sources came forward and said, there's this teenage boy running around. But Buckland was insistent that he had only killed Dawn and not Linda. So this presented a quandary for investigators. The man in charge of the Leicestershire Criminal Investigation Department was Detective Chief Superintendent David Baker, and he had been aware of the development of DNA fingerprinting for some time. He's heard about it, he's read about it, and with the problem of Buckland confessing to Don's murder and denying responsibility for Linda's, Baker felt it may be time to put this new technique to the test. So Detective Chief Superintendent David Baker reached out to Alec Jeffries, a genetics researcher at the local university, which was actually less than 10 miles from where the two girls were murdered. Jeffrey's discovery of DNA profiling was quite accidental. Excuse me. He'd been researching hereditary diseases when he had this sort of euphoria moment, which led to what began as a side project. This is literally telling the story of how this guy came up with DNA profiling. Jeffrey's eventually developed DNA fingerprinting, along with Peter Gill and David Werrett of the Forensic Science Service. It had already been used successfully in a maternity case. Like I mentioned earlier in that case, it was proven that a French teenager was the father of an English divorcee's child. That was a history-making event, though it didn't make much of a media splash at the time. When he was approached by David Baker, Alec Jeffries, who was quite familiar with the Footpath murders, was more than happy to help. So Jeffries started with the degraded semen sample from the Linda Mann murder, and he was able to develop what he called the genetic signature, which is now what we call a DNA profile. So he comes up with a DNA profile of Linda's killer, then developed a DNA profile from a blood sample taken from Richard Buckland. The man who killed Linda was not Richard Buckland. He had just been eliminated using DNA profiling. A week then passed before a full DNA profile was developed from the sample taken from the semen found inside Don Ashworth. Don's killer was the same man who killed Linda. Therefore, Richard was innocent in both murders. So he just admitted to it, but he didn't do it. Jeffries then broke the news to Detective Chief Superintendent David Baker, who was floored. Asking any chance of a mistake, Alec Jeffries was wondering the same thing himself, so he had the test repeated by independent parties at the home office. And they reached the exact same conclusion. and Richard Buckland was then released. Buckland later explained that the pressure the interrogators imposed on him was too much, and he ultimately just caved and falsely confessed, believing there was no other way out of the situation. And what Richard may not have fully appreciated in that moment was that he had just made history, becoming the first man to be exonerated by DNA evidence. Alec Jeffries later stated they had no doubt that Buckland would have been tried and found guilty had it not been for that DNA. He's like, 100% this guy would have served a prison sentence for this if DNA had not excluded him. But now the hunt was on again for the sadistic killer of the two 15-year-old schoolgirls on the footpaths. They had more to go on here because now they knew for sure it was the same killer. Imagine having to explain to Don's family that although this kid confessed and had acted extremely weird after the murder, this new science experiment, science has found, confirmed he didn't do it. Like, a DNA profile wasn't even a phrase yet. I'm sure they could wrap their minds around it because of fingerprinting and blood types, but still, it was probably really hard for them to be like, what do you mean this little test just said he didn't do it? He said he did do it. The county police now believe in the legitimacy of this new technique, and they came up with a novel idea, a genetic dragnet. In January 1987, a massive coordinated campaign was organized between both the villages of Narborough and Enderby, as well as the nearby village of Littlethorpe, where they asked more than 5,500 local men between the ages of 17 and 34 to give their blood in an effort to identify the footpath killer. Essentially, they were creating the first DNA database without even realizing it. Imagine how expensive the investigation must have been by this point with all this new scientific stuff. This was such an ambitious effort, and it's the kind you wouldn't really have seen in a larger city where crimes like rape and murder are more of a common thing. But some reasonable corners were cut here. Of the blood samples they collected, they only tested those who had the same blood type 8A, with a PGM1+ enzyme, as the killer. So that's 10% of the population. So they were really able to cut down their field quite a bit. And so once all 5,500 samples were obtained, roughly 550 of those would have been DNA tested. This collection effort would end up spanning 6 whole months. And unfortunately, once all the samples were tested, none of them matched the footpath killer. That was until August 1st of that year, a year and a day from the date of Don Ashworth's murder. That Saturday afternoon, some bakery workers on their lunch break were drinking at a local pub called the Clarendon, when one of the workers, a man named Ian Kelly, made an interesting claim. Kelly claimed that his co-worker at the bakery, a guy named Colin Pitchfork, had offered him 200 quid to masquerade as Colin and take the blood test for him. Pitchfork, Kelly said, had already given a sample for another guy, a friend of his, and now he needed someone to cover for him, to go show up and be him to take the test. He also told his co-worker he'd had encounters with the police in the past and didn't really want to deal with them. So he's like, can you just do this for me? Ian had agreed. The two men then went to a photo booth where Ian had his picture taken, and then Colin took the photo of Ian back home and inserted it into his passport, replacing his own photo. Kelly then showed up to give the blood sample as Colin Pitchfork, using Pitchfork's doctored passport. Ian, Kelly's manager at the bakery, who was also at the pub and part of his conversation, walked away from it troubled, and it continued to gnaw at her until she finally just went to the police, a little over a month later, to tell them what she had overheard. Police looked at the signature on the form that Colin Pitchfork had allegedly signed when giving his blood, and they noticed that it did not match Colin Pitchfork's other known signatures. They think that what his co-worker had just told them was true. So they decided at this point to arrest Ian Kelly, the man who went and took the test for Pitchfork, and he admitted to covering for Colin. He told them the whole story. Colin was a 27-year-old baker with his own side business decorating cakes. He was a married father of two young boys, and a man with multiple previous arrests for flashing and indecent exposure with teenage girls. In 1980, he was even sent for psychiatric counseling at the Carlton Hayes Hospital. psychiatric hospital sandwiched between the two footpaths. Considering all this, the police arrested Colin Pitchfork on September 19th, 1987, and he confessed almost immediately to both footpath murders. The police, meanwhile, took Colin Pitchfork's blood and compared the DNA to the DNA of the footpath killer. Investigators learned of other incidents that Colin Pitchfork had been involved in, including two sexual assaults and a kidnapping. In the kidnapping incident, Pitchfork had offered a ride to a 17-year-old girl named Liz Knight, whom he had spotted walking home by herself late at night. She'd asked him before getting into the car if he was a rapist, which he assured her he wasn't. It wasn't until she got into his car and buckled up that she noticed him staring at her in a way that made her pretty nervous. He had really revolting dead eyes, she said, and just stared right through me. I knew then that I had made a mistake. And indeed, she had. As they approached her turnoff, Colin didn't reduce speed and ignored her directions. He just kept right on going, not saying another thing to her, accelerating faster as an evil smirk appeared on his face. That's when Liz took the steering wheel and struggled with him as she tried to force him off the road. He slammed on the brakes and yelled at her, "I thought you wanted it. I thought this is what you wanted. All I want is to go home," she cried. Colin regained his composure, turned the car around in the direction of her home, and explained that he'd had a couple of drinks. Liz then offered to drive if he was too drunk. "I haven't hurt you yet," Colin reassured the sobbing teenager as he put his hand on her knee. As they approached the turnoff, he slowed the car to stop, and as the trembling young woman unbuckled her seatbelt, he asked her, "How about a goodnight kiss then?" Saying nothing, she bolted from his car. Before driving away, he said to her, "I bet you'll never accept a lift from a stranger again." So this girl could have easily been murdered, just like the other girls. But somehow, she escapes. Can't believe he's married and has two kids. Like, what a sickening human being. Colin was charged with two counts of murder, two counts of sexual assault, one count of kidnapping, one count of conspiracy to pervert justice for having his workmate pose as him for the blood collection. The workmate, Ian Kelly, was himself convicted of this charge and received an 18-month suspended sentence. A psychiatric report that was compiled by a doctor diagnosed Pitchfork as a psychopath. He was sentenced to two life terms, which carried, at the time, a minimum of sentence of 30 years. At his sentencing, the high court judge said to Colin Pitchfork, "The rapes and murders were of a particularly sadistic kind, and if it wasn't for DNA, it might still be at large today, and other women would still be in danger." And the Lord Chief Justice stated, from the point of view of the safety of the public, "I doubt you should ever be released." Pitchfork has apparently been a model prisoner. While incarcerated, he earned a degree, became an expert of the transcription of printed music into Braille, and also became an accomplished artist. One of his sculptures was actually exhibited at the Royal Festival Hall in 2009, a sculpture called Bringing the Music to Life, but there was an outcry from victim advocacy groups, and the sculpture was promptly removed. Which, I mean, duh, you can't put a sculpture up from a guy who's serving life in prison. It doesn't make sense. And then, incredibly, in 2016, the parole board moved Colin Pitchfork to an open prison, which means the prisoners are allowed employment outside the prison and limited access to the community. And the following year, Colin Pitchfork was indeed seen and photographed walking around Bristol. He was being allowed unsupervised days at this point. So he is back out in the community. This is pretty astounding. Some key differences there between the UK prison system and how things are done here in the States. But then in 2021, Pitchfork was actually granted release on what's called a conditional license, which is sort of like probation where he's closely monitored and required to follow a strict set of rules and guidelines. At this time that he's being released, the number of conditions Pitchfork had to respect was more than five times what the average paroled murderer would have to agree to. And those included a GPS tag to monitor his movements, exclusion zones, curfews, polygraph tests. It was the most restrictive set of conditions ever imposed on a paroled prisoner in England. However, only 2 months after his release, that release was revoked. and Colin Pitchfork was returned to prison. Because it was reported that he had been, get this, approaching young women while out in walks from the Halt halfway house where he was living. And it was the probation staff at the halfway house that raised these concerns. It was also learned that Pitchfork was learning breathing techniques that would allow him to fool his polygraph test that he was supposed to be taking. But that is the story of the Footpath murders and the birth of DNA profiling. Can you believe that this story, it's like super bittersweet just in the fact that it's horrible that those two girls are dead, but also amazing that DNA was able to catch him. So that is our case for this week. Let me know your thoughts in the comment section below. As always, give us a thumbs up if you like your video. Hit the subscribe button down below. Hit that bell notification button to be notified of future episodes. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS or scan the QR code on the screen. And of course, everything you give, whether it's $1, $5, $20, $50, $100, however much you give, goes right back into this channel. We use it mainly to upgrade our equipment. We'll bring in new hosts, be able to pay them. We'll be able to take this show on the road. We'll be able to do live episodes from crime scenes from all over the country, past or present. And hopefully, possibly, do live episodes from trials that are ongoing. And your support can help make that happen. And if you can't give, it's totally fine. If you can't give financially, consider, yeah, just giving us a thumbs up if you like the video. Or just leave a comment. And as always, you can find us on all major podcast platforms, whether it's Amazon, Good Pods, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts from, you can find us. So as always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time. Take care.